Chapter 66. Ukrainians and Jews. The Allies, after rendering Germany impotent, moved on to dismember the old Austro-Hungarian Empire, the bulwark of Western civilization for more than 1,000 years. The dismemberment started as early as January 1919 in Poland. An individualistic country, Poland had a strong history of war, invasion, and internal rivalries. It had lost its independence on several occasions due to a combination of factors, which included geography, a volatile temperament, and the presence of large numbers of aliens among the Polish people. But it was mostly this last factor, disunity, which spurred violent reactions among the Poles. These conflicts, which had contributed so much to Poland's misfortune, should have been known to those who wished to restore Poland in 1919. Wisdom dictated they should not be revived, let alone magnified. There would be no sense in establishing a Polish state in which nearly half of the population would be non-Polish. Wilson had gone out of his way to signal that there should be no annexations or trading of populations, especially in the ethnic patchwork of Eastern Europe, the peoples of Central Europe, and that had been approved in writing by the Allies will themselves decide on their fate after due consideration. Wilson was in favor of restoring Poland, and he established the geographic and ethnic limits of this new country. An independent Polish state should be created. It should include territories inhabited by people who are irrefutably Polish. These territories should be ensured of a free and guaranteed access to the sea. The two basic points, irrefutably Polish and free and guaranteed access to the sea, were very precise. Yet more than 10 million non-Poles were annexed into the new Poland without being asked, and access to the sea would be interpreted as authorization to seize the land of another country. The issue of access to the sea might have been resolved in numerous ways, either in the form of a free port, transit rights, or, as Marshal Joseph Pilsudski had proposed with great wisdom, an internationalization of access routes in a manner beneficial to both Poland and Germany. If Pilsudski's formula had been adopted, it is possible that the world would have been spared World War II. Access to the sea did not mean seizing foreign territory or cutting a corridor through the territory of a neighboring country, thereby effectively cutting this country in half and denationalizing large cities against the will of their citizens. To do so was to create the certitude of future conflict. Many countries, in any case, live very well without seaports or coastlines. Switzerland, a land of freedom and prosperity, possesses neither a seaport nor access to one. Hungary, Austria, Czechoslovakia, some 20 Asian and African countries, and Latin American countries like Paraguay and Bolivia have no access to the sea. In the case of Poland, the solution depended on a formula of fairness, objectivity, and vision. Unfortunately, the Treaty of Versailles was not about wisdom and reconciliation, but was motivated by hatred and imperialism. French politicians were playing politics, with a program of vengeance against Germany, expansion into the western part of Germany, and a Central European policy of interference. This policy created new states such as Czechoslovakia, which absorbed millions of unwilling people, and Yugoslavia, which was a construct enabling Serbia to rule over non-Serbians three times its own population. Poland and Romania would also be considerably enlarged with non-citizens who did not belong to them and who did not wish to belong to them. Clemenceau saw these new states as a kind of second front, states deputized by him to contain Germany. For once, despite his 14 points, Wilson agreed with Clemenceau. Wilson and Clemenceau had had bitter exchanges, but the president went along with Clemenceau's plan to create a revived and newly bloated Poland. Wilson sought to curry favor with Polish-American voters whom he thought of as vital to future democratic electoral hopes. The Polish plan triggered violent reactions among the Poles themselves. As early as January 1, 1919, no fewer than 30 different Polish delegates, all claiming to represent the Polish government, angrily stormed the peace conference at Paris. "For 4 days now," wrote American delegate Major Bonsai on January 5, 1919, "we have been suffering a flood of Poles. Since each country could only be represented by two delegates, it was necessary to lock up the 30 rivals in the conference room of the hotel occupied by the Americans. It was a terrible scandal, Bonsai reported. They screamed for 2 ear-splitting hours until in the third hour they all had lost their voices. It was only then that 2 delegates were chosen. The delegates were the pianist Ignace Paderewski and a politician, Roman Dmofsky. Wilson was anxious to promote Paderewski, who had lived in the United States previously, in order to neutralize Pilsudski, who had already assumed power in Warsaw. The saying, "Get 4 Poles together and you have 5 disputes, proved correct in this newly improvised Poland. Warsaw would soon become a boxing ring for quarreling politicians. There would be coups and counter-coups. The Poles would, however, be united on the subject of enlarging their country to the maximum. Most of them, wrote a Wilson advisor, only aimed at the biggest territorial expansion possible without the slightest regard to neighboring countries, Eastern Prussia, Danzig, Eastern Galicia, which was mostly inhabited by Ruthenians, all would be absorbed. I. Bowman, The New World, page 278. After having swallowed more than 10 million non-Poles, who were violently anti-Polish, the Poland created by the Versailles Treaty would prove an impossible puzzle, eventually to be blown away within 4 weeks in 1939. The American delegate Professor Howard Lord had warned the Allied signatories, the defense of such a state would probably constitute a burden for the treaty signatories. Consequently, the more disputed territories given to Poland, the more trouble there will be. What happened in Paris, page 68. Even more numerous than the Germans, hereditary enemies of Poland, were totally different peoples: the Ukrainians, the Galicians, the White Russians, the Lithuanians, and a vast number of Jews who would be thrown into the Polish popery. The Polish politicians were so voracious that for a few months Poland stretched from the Baltic to the Black Sea, gobbling up some 30 million non-Poles in the process. Before the armistice was signed, Poland, not yet reborn, had found its master in the person of Joseph Pilsudski. Born in Vilna in Lithuania, Pilsudski was a radical socialist agitator who had been deported to Siberia and then returned to join Germany against the Tsar. After the fall of Imperial Russia, he turned against the Germans and devoted his energy to the expansion of Poland. Becoming virtual dictator of Poland, he did not tolerate opposition gladly. He acquired neighboring territory by a mixture of force and cunning. The French ambassador in Warsaw described the seizure of Vilna, the ancient capital of Lithuania, with its 200,000 citizens. Pilsudski called one of his military friends, General Zelagowski, and told him, "With your troops, go and march on Vilna and take it. Stay there. The Allies will protest and I will blame you. I will discharge you, but we will keep Vilna." Leon Noel, German Aggression Against Poland, page 51. Without further ado, Pilsudski had thus put hundreds of thousands of Lithuanians under his rule. They had not the slightest wish to become Polish subjects and protested vehemently. But it was in vain. Somehow the Allies did not hear these particular cries for self-determination. Pilsudski then rushed on to Kiev, annexing the whole of northwestern Ukraine, although these regions had no Polish population. The adventure turned sour and the Soviets attacked the invaders and pushed them right back to Warsaw. Had it not been for the power struggle between Stalin and the Soviet generals commanding the anti-Polish offensive, and the help the French general Vigan brought Pilsudski, Poland would have been Sovietized right then and there, a full 25 years before Potsdam. Pilsudski had been saved by the skin of his teeth, but his appetite for territory had not been diminished. The Treaty of Paris recognized Pilsudski's occupation of Eastern Galicia, although the National Committee of Galicians had sent a delegation protesting the invasion of their country. The representatives of the Ukrainian people protest the annexation of a part of the Ukraine by Poland, including the Ukrainian lands of Chom, Podolia, and Volhynia. "We consider it an attack against the Ukrainian people, a violation of its historic rights and a mockery of the principle of self-determination for all peoples." The Polish Commission at Versailles told the Ukrainians that guarantees would be given for the protection of the national rights of 3 million Ukrainians within an autonomous province recognized by Poland. In fact, there were 5 million Ukrainians in Galicia. To soften the blow, the Commission palmed off on the Ukrainians the old trick of the delayed plebiscite, they could vote on whether they wanted to be part of Poland in 25 years. The Ukrainians of Galicia would never be allowed to vote on their fate or unite with the other Ukrainians. Ukraine, a nation as large as France, with 40 million people, was cut in half in 1919. The democracies chose to ignore their rights then and have continued to do so, down to this very day. Another factor sealing the fate of the 5 million Ukrainians of Galicia was the recently discovered oil fields of the Carpathians. The British establishment had invested heavily in the exploitation of this oil and felt more comfortable with Polish control of the region. The British and the French governments were suddenly vying for the privilege of being Poland's protector. Wilson had asked Major Bonsall to see the Ukrainian delegation. On May 3, 1919, a month before the ratification of the Versailles Treaty, Edward Mandel House ordered Bonsall to burn the 10 volumes of the dossier he had been presented by the delegation. Bonsall threw them in the large oven of the Crillon Hotel. Somehow, the bulky documents did not burn. Amazingly, recalled Bonsall, they shrank and got brownish, a little. When I told House, he said, "I hope it's not an omen." I replied, "So do I, but I have my doubts." Thus the legitimate requests of the Ukrainians not to be occupied by a foreign power ended up in the oven of the Crillon Hotel. Jews were yet another group included in the New Poland of the Versailles Treaty. Millions of them had come from Russia. The French ambassador in Warsaw, Leon Noel, reported, the Tsar's government favored the departure of Jews from Western Russia. They landed in the land of the Vistula, as the Russian bureaucracy called Poland. The Jews of Russian origin were very foreign to the Poles. Noel described the state of the Jewish population in Poland. Who has not traveled across the Polish countryside between the two wars without seeing Jews crawling in every village, every town, every city? Living off the Christian population. These innumerable Jews, dirty, hairy, and sallow, could be seen either rushing to make money or standing in front of their shops or hovels lost in some messianic or money scheme. No one who hasn't seen this will ever understand what the Jewish problem in Europe was. In Poland, the Jews had monopolized the fur, leather, and clothing trade. In Warsaw, they were in finance, usury, antique shops, department stores, they were bankers, lawyers, and doctors. They controlled agriculture as middlemen. Poles were driven out of business by Jewish practices and anti-Semitism was growing rapidly. In many cases, Jews were responsible for the conflict. They were arrogant and showed open contempt for the Christians. They went out of their way to provoke the Poles. The Jewish problem seemed insoluble. The Jews were too numerous to be assimilated. In any case, they did not want assimilation. They were tied to their own practices and to their ghettos. In the town of Gdynia, they would not socialize with the Poles, they stood apart from Polish life. They spoke Yiddish, which they wrote in Hebraic characters. It was an alien world in the midst of Poland. Poland could have been spared such a problem if its politicians had not absorbed neighboring lands and with them millions of unassimilable Jews. At the beginning of 1919, the president of the Polish Ministerial Council, Roman Dmowski, also a delegate to the peace conference at Paris, would make startling statements to the World Assembly. These Oriental Jews form a very particular group. Their activities are causing much distress with those who have to live near them on a daily basis. The Polish delegate added, "If we do not impose certain restrictions very quickly, all our lawyers, doctors, and businessmen will be Jews." The Poles had not waited for the Nuremberg laws to demand protection from Jewish practices, they demanded it at the Paris Peace Conference in 1919. The American delegate Isaiah Bowman illustrated Polish laws governing Polish-Jewish relations. In Galicia, for example, Jews were forbidden by law to engage in trading grain, alcohol, and salt. Christians were not allowed to employ Jews. One must also say that the Jews represented 14% of the Russian-Polish population, yet they were 84% of the businessmen, 20% of the writers, 51% of the teachers, 24% of the doctors, while only 2% were farmers, workers, and miners. Pilsudski, by doubling the number of Jews under his control, had only doubled Poland's problems. The Jews of Poland had never assimilated, and the influx of some 2 additional millions made any solution impossible. The U.S. delegates, headed by Mandel House, were instructed to convince the Poles of the benefits of Jewish immigration. They mentioned that New York alone had more Jews than the whole of the New Poland and went on to list all the Jewish governors, mayors, congressmen, senators, writers, bankers, et al. That was precisely what the Poles were determined to avoid by way of legislation. House was shocked to hear President Dmowski's demands and complaints, particularly since he had worked so hard to give birth to the new Polish government. In January 1919, House formally declared, against Polish wishes, that the 3 million Jews of Poland must be officially and strongly protected. Before giving the Poles their independence, they must undertake very seriously to guarantee a just and equal treatment of religious and racial minorities. Despite House's pressure, the Poles would go ahead and enact whatever laws they thought necessary to protect themselves. The Jews of Poland would remain outside the law until 1939. The Polish government was so desperate to get rid of its Jewish population that it proposed, long before anyone else, that Madagascar should be the recipient of Polish Jews. Many Jews left Poland and settled in France. However, the bulk of Polish Jews remained in Poland as a hostile group against the government. Poland's problems were compounded by the 7 million Ukrainians and Germans who had been annexed against their will. Lloyd George had warned Clemenceau, "Because of Danzig, we will have a new war."